New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Over the last 75 years, over 10,000 chemicals have been introduced to our food supply. Yet the EU only allows 300 food additives. But at Thrive Market, we bring our members the highest quality brands and restrict more than 1,000 ingredients found at conventional grocery stores. Making the switch is easy with our Healthy Swaps scanner, which finds better versions of all your favorite pantry, snacking, and home essentials without the added junk, dyes, and fillers. Plus, it's all delivered straight to your door. So if you're looking to shop at a grocery store that actually cares about your health, go to thrivemarket.com/podcast and you'll get 30% off your first order and a free gift.
Chapter 1, Book 3 of Rookwood. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This reading by Paul Curran. Rookwood by William Harrison Ainsworth. Book 3. The Gypsy. Lay a garland on my hearse of the dismal yew. Maidens willow branches bear. Say I died true. My love was false, but I was firm from my hour of birth. Upon my buried body lie lightly, gentle earth. Beaumont and Fletcher. Chapter 1. A Morning Ride. I had a sister, who, among the race of gypsies, was the fairest. Fair she was in gentle blood, and gesture to her beauty. Brome. On quitting Lady Rookwood's chamber, Luke speeded along the gloomy corridor, descended the spiral stairs, and, swiftly traversing sundry other dark passages, issued from a door at the back of the house. Day was just beginning to break. His first object had been to furnish himself with a means to expedite his flight, and, perceiving no one in the yard, he directed his hasty steps towards the stable. The door was fortunately unfastened, and, entering, he found a strong roan horse, which he knew, from description, had been his father's favourite hunter, and to the use of which he now considered himself fully entitled. The animal roused himself as he approached, shook his glossy coat, and neighed, as if he recognised the footsteps and voice. "Thou art mistaken, old fellow," said Luke. "I am not he thou thinkest. Nevertheless, I am glad thy instinct would have it so. If thou bearest my father's son as thou hast borne thy old master o'er many a field for many a day, he need not fear the best mounted of his pursuers. So ho, come hither, Rook!" The noble steed turned at the call. Luke hastily saddled him, vaulted upon his back, and disregarding every impediment in the shape of fence or ditch, shaped his course across the field towards the sexton's cottage, which he reached just as his owner was in the act of unlocking his door. Peter testified his delight and surprise at the escape of his grandson by a greeting of chuckling laughter.
"How? Escaped?" exclaimed he. "Who has delivered you from the hands of the Moabites? Ah, but why do I ask? Who could it have been but Jack Palmer?"
"My own hands have set me free," returned Luke. "I am indebted to no man for liberty, still less to him. But I cannot tarry here. Each moment is precious. I came to request you to accompany me to the gypsy encampment. Will you go or not?"
"And mount behind you?" replied Peter. "I like not the manner of conveyance."
"Farewell, then," and Luke turned to depart.
"Stay, that is Sir Piers' horse, old Rook. I care not if I do ride him."
"Quick, then, mount."
"I will not delay you a moment," rejoined the sexton,
opening his door and throwing his implements into the cottage.
"Back, Moll! Back, sir!"
cried he, as the dog rushed out to greet him.
"Bring your steed nigh this stone, grandson Luke. There, a little nearer, all's right."
And away they galloped. The sexton's first inquiries were directed to ascertain how Luke had accomplished his escape, and, having satisfied himself in this particular, he was content to remain silent, musing, it might be, on the incidents detailed to him. The road Luke chose was a rough, unfrequented lane that skirted for nearly a mile the moss-grown railings of the park. It then diverged to the right, and seemed to bear towards a range of hills rising in the distance. High hedges impeded the view on either side, but there were occasional gaps, affording glimpses of the tract of country through which he was riding. Meadows were seen steaming with heavy dews, intersected by a deep channelled stream, whose course was marked by a hanging cloud of vapour, as well as by a row of melancholy pollard willows that stood like stripped, shivering urchins by the riverside. Other fields succeeded, yellow with the golden grain, or bright with flowering clover, the autumnal crop, coloured with every shade from the light green of the turnip to the darker verdure of the bean, the various products of the teeming land. The whole was backed by round, drowsy masses of trees. Luke spoke not, nor abated his furious course, till the road began to climb a steep ascent. He then drew in the rein, and from the heights of the acclivity surveyed the plain over which he had passed. It was a rich, agricultural district, with little picturesque beauty, but much of true English endearing loveliness to recommend it. Such a quiet, pleasing landscape, in short, as one views at such season of the year from every eminence in every country of our merry isle. The picture was made up of a tract of land, filled with corn ripe for the sickle, or studded with sheaves of the same golden produce, enlivened with green meadows, so deeply luxuriant as to claim the scythe for the second time, each divided from the other by thick hedgerows, the uniformity of which was broken ever and anon by some towering elm, tall poplar, or wide-branching oak. Many old farmhouses, with their broad barns and crowded haystacks, forming little villages in themselves, ornamented the landscape at different points, and by their substantial look evidenced the fertility of the soil and the thriving condition of its inhabitants. Some 3 miles distant might be seen the scattered hamlet of Rookwood, the dark, russet thatch of its houses scarcely perceptible amidst the embrowned foliage of the surrounding timber. The site of the village was, however, pointed out by the square tower of the antique church that crested the summit of the adjoining hill. And although the hall was entirely hidden from view, Luke readily traced out its locality amidst the depths of the dark grove in which it was embosomed. This goodly prospect had other claims to attention in Luke's eye besides its agricultural or pictorial merit. It was, or he deemed it was, his own. Far as his eye ranged, yea, even beyond the line of vision, the estates of Rookwood extended.
"Do you see that house below us in the valley?" asked Peter of his companion.
"I do," replied Luke. "A snug old house, a model of a farm. Everything looks comfortable and well-to-do about it. There are a dozen lusty haystacks or thereabouts, and the great barn with its roof yellowed like gold looks built for a granary, and there are stables, kine houses, orchards, dovecots, and fish-ponds, and an old circular garden with wall fruit in abundance. He should be a happy man and a wealthy one who dwells therein."
"He dwells therein no longer," returned Peter. "He died last night."
"How do you know that? None are stirring in the house as yet."
"The owner of that house, Simon Toft," replied Peter, "was last night struck by a thunderbolt. He was one of the coffin bearers at your father's funeral. They are sleeping within the house, you say? 'Tis well. Let them sleep on. They will awaken too soon, when wake they may."
"Peace!" cried Luke. "You blight everything. Even this smiling landscape you would turn to gloom. Does not the morn awaken a happier train of thoughts within your mind? With me it makes amends for want of sleep, effaces resentment, and banishes every black misgiving. 'Tis a joyous thing thus to scour the country at earliest dawn, to catch all the spirit and freshness of the morning, to be abroad before the lazy world is half awake, to make the most of a brief existence, and to have spent a day of keen enjoyment, almost before the day begins with some. I like to anticipate the rising of the glorious luminary, to watch every line of light changing as at this moment, from shuddering grey to blushing rose. See how the heavens are dyed! Who would exchange yon gorgeous spectacle," continued he, pointing towards the east, and again urging his horse to full speed down the hill, endangering the sexton's seat, and threatening to impale him upon the crupper of the saddle. Who would exchange that sight, and the exhilarating feeling of this fresh morn, for a couch of eiderdown, and a headache in reversion?
"I, for one," returned the sexton sharply, "would willingly exchange it for that, or any other couch, provided it rid me of this accursed crupper which galls me sorely. Moderate your pace, grandson Luke, or I must throw myself off the horse in self-defence."
Luke slackened his charger's pace, in compliance with the sexton's wish.
"Ah, well," continued Peter, restored in a measure to comfort, "now I can contemplate the sunrise which you laud, somewhat at mine ease. 'Tis a fine sight, I doubt not, to the eyes of youth, and to the sanguine soul of him upon whom life itself is dawning is, I dare say, inspiriting. But when the heyday of existence is past, when the blood flows sluggishly in the veins, when one has known the desolating storms which the brightest sunrise has preceded, the seared heart refuses to trust its false glitter, and, like the experienced sailor, sees oft in the brightest skies a forecast of the tempest. To such a one there can be no new dawn of the heart. No sun can gild its cold and cheerless horizon. No breeze can revive pulses that have long since ceased to throb with any chance of emotion. I am too old to feel freshness in this nipping air. It chills me more than the damps of night, to which I am accustomed. Night, midnight, is my season of delight. Nature is instinct, then, with the secrets dark and dread. There is a language which he who sleepeth not, but will wake and watch, may haply learn. Strange organs of speech hath the invisible world. Strange language doth it talk. Strange communion hold with him who would pry into its mysteries. It talks by bat and owl, by the grave worm and each crawling thing, by the dust of graves, as well as by those that rot therein. But ever doth it discourse by night, and specially when the moon is at the full, 'tis the lore I have then learned that makes that season dear to me. Like your cat, mine eye expands in darkness. I blink at the sunshine, like your owl." "Cease this forbidding strain," returned Luke. "It sounds as harshly as your own screech owl's cry. Let your thoughts make a more sprightly turn, more in unison with my own and the fair aspect of nature." "Shall I direct them to the gypsies' camp, then?" said Peter with a sneer. "Do your own thoughts tend thither?"
"You are not altogether in the wrong," replied Luke. "I was thinking of the gypsies' camp, and of one who dwells amongst its tents."
"I knew it," replied Peter. "Did you hope to deceive me by attributing all your joyousness of heart to the dawn? Your thoughts have been wandering all this while upon one who hath, I will engage, a pair of shoe-black eyes, an olive skin, and yet withal a clear tone, black, yet comely as the tents of Kedar, as the curtains of Solomon, a mesh of jetty hair that hath entangled you in its network, ripe lips and a cunning tongue, one of the plagues of Egypt."
"You've guessed shrewdly," replied Luke. "I care not to own that my thoughts were so occupied."
"I was assured of it," replied the sexton. "And what may be the name of her towards whom your imagination was straying?"
"Sibylla Perez," replied Luke. "Her father was a Spanish gitano. She's known amongst her people by her mother's name of Lovell."
"She's beautiful, of course."
"Aye, very beautiful. But no matter. You shall judge of her charms anon."
"I will take your word for them," returned the sexton. "And you love her?"
"Passionately."
"You are not married?" asked Peter, hastily.
"Not as yet," replied Luke, "but my faith is plighted."
"Heaven be praised! The mischief is not then irreparable. I would have you married, though not to a gypsy girl."
"And whom would you select?"
"One before whom Sybil's beauty would pale as stars at day's approach."
"There lives not such one."
"Trust me, there does. Eleanor Mowbray is lovely beyond parallel. I was mere speculating upon a possibility when I wished her yours. It is scarcely likely she would cast her eyes upon you."
"I shall not heed her neglect. Graced with my title, I doubt not, were it my pleasure to seek a bride amongst those of gentle blood, I should not find all indifferent to my suit."
"Possibly not. Yet what might weigh with others would not weigh with her. There are qualities you lack which she has discovered in another."
"In whom?"
"In Ranulph Rookwood."
"Is he her suitor?"
"I have reason to think so." "'And you would have me abandon my own betrothed love "'to beguile from my brother his destined bride? "'That were to imitate the conduct of my grandsire, "'the terrible Reginald, towards his brother Alan.' "'The sexton answered not, "'and Luke fancied he could perceive a quivering "'in the hands that grasped his body for support. "'There was a brief pause in their conversation. "'And who is Eleanor Mowbray?' asked Luke, breaking the silence. "'Your cousin, on the mother's side of Rookwood. "'Tis therefore I would urge your union with her. "'There is a prophecy relating to your house, "'which seems as though it would be fulfilled in your person and in hers. "'When the stray rook shall perch on the topmost bough, "'there shall be clamour and screaming, I trow, "'but of right and of rule of the ancient nest, "'the rook that with rook mate shall hold him possessed.' "'I place no faith in such fantasies,' replied Luke, "'and yet the lines bear strangely upon my present situation. "'Their application to yourself and Eleanor Mowbray is unquestionable,' replied the sexton. "'It would seem so, indeed,' rejoined Luke, "'and he again sank into abstraction, "'from which the sexton did not care to rouse him. "'The aspect of the country had materially changed since their descent of the hill.' In place of the richly cultivated district which lay on the other side, a broad brown tract of wasteland spread out before them, covered with scattered patches of gorse, stunted fern, and low brushwood, presenting an unvaried surface of unbaked turf. The shallow coat of sod was manifested by the stones that clattered under the horse's hoofs as he rapidly traversed the arid soil, clearing with ease to himself, though not without discomfort to the sexton, every gravelly trench, natural chasm, or other inequality of ground that occurred in his course. Clinging to his grandson with the tenacity of a bird of prey, Peter for some time kept his station in security. But, unluckily, at one dyke rather wider than the rest, the horse, owing possibly to the mismanagement, intentional or otherwise, of Luke, swerved, and the sexton, dislodged from his high estate, fell at the edge of the trench, and rolled incontinently to the bottom. Luke drew in the rein to inquire if any bones were broken, and Peter presently upreared his dusty person from the abyss, and without condescending to make reply, yet muttering curses, not loud, but deep, accepted his grandson's proffered hand and remounted. While thus occupied, Luke fancied he heard a distant shout, and noting whence the sound proceeded, the same quarter by which he had approached the heath, he beheld a single horseman spurring in their direction at the top of his speed, and to judge from the rate at which he advanced, it was evident he was anything but indifferently mounted. Apprehensive of pursuit, Luke expedited the sexton's ascent, and that accomplished, without bestowing further regard upon the object of his solicitude, he resumed his headlong flight. He now thought it necessary to bestow more attention on his choice of road, and, perfectly acquainted with the heath, avoided all unnecessary hazardous passes. In spite of his knowledge of the ground, and the excellence of his horse, the stranger sensibly gained upon him. The danger, however, was no longer imminent. "'We are safe!' cried Luke. "'The limits of hard chase are past. In a few seconds we shall enter Davenham Wood. I will turn the horse loose, and we will betake ourselves to flight amongst the trees. I will show you a place of concealment.' "'He cannot follow us on horseback, and on foot I defy him.' "'Stay!' cried the sexton. "'He is not in pursuit. He takes another course. He wheels to the right. By heaven, it is the fiend himself upon a black horse come for bow-legged Ben. See, he is there already!' The horseman had turned, as the sexton stated, careering towards a revolting object at some little distance on the right. It was a gibbet with its grisly burden. He rode swiftly towards it, and, reining in his horse, took off his hat, bowing profoundly to the carcass that swung in the morning breeze. Just at that moment a gust of air catching the fleshless skeleton, its arms seemed to be waved in reply to the salutation. A solitary crow winged its flight over the horseman's head as he paused. After a moment's halt, he wheeled about and again shouted to Luke, waving his hat. "'As I live!' said the latter. "'It is Jack Palmer!'
"'Dick Turpin, you mean,' rejoined the sexton. "'He has been paying his respects to a brother blade. "'Ah, Dick will never have the honour of a gibbet. "'He is too tender of the knife. "'Did you mark the crow? "'But here he comes.' "'And in another instant, Turpin was by their side.
End of chapter 1, book 3. Chapter 2, book 3 of Rookwood. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This reading by Paul Curran. Rookwood by William Harrison Ainsworth. Book 3, Chapter 2, A Gypsy Encampment. I see a column of slow-rising smoke o'ertop the lofty wood that skirts the wild. Cowper, The Task.
"The top of the morning to you, gemmen,"
said Turpin, as he rode up at an easy canter. "Did you not hear my halloo? I caught a glimpse of you on the hill yonder. I knew you both, 2 miles off, and so, having a word or two to say to you, Luke Bradley, before I leave this part of the country, I put Bess to it, and she soon brought me within hail, bless her black skin," added he, affectionately patting his horse's neck. "There's not a match in these parts, nor in any other. She wants no coaxing to do her work, no bleeders for her. I should have been up with you before this, had I not taken a cross-cut to look at poor Ben. One night, when mounted on my mare, to Bagshot Heath I did repair, and saw Will Davis hanging there, upon the gibbet bleak and bare, with a rustified, fustified, mustified air. Excuse my singing. The sight of a gibbet always puts me in mind of the golden farmer. May I ask whither you are bound, comrades?"
"Comrades," whispered the sexton to Luke. "You see, he does not so easily forget his old friends."
"I have business that will not admit of delay," rejoined Luke. "And to speak plainly..."
"You want not my society," returned Turpin. "I guessed as much, natural enough. You have got an inkling of your good fortune. You have found out you are a rich man's heir, not a poor wench's bastard. No offence. I'm a plain-spoken man, as you will find, if you know it not already. I have no objection to your playing these fine tricks on others, though it won't answer your turn to do so with me."
"Sir!" exclaimed Luke sharply.
"Sir, to you," replied Turpin. "Sir Luke, as I suppose you would now choose to be addressed. I'm aware of all. A nod is as good as a wink to me. Last night I learned the fact of Sir Piers' marriage from Lady Rookwood."
"Aye,
from her ladyship. You stare, and old Peter there opens his ogles now. She let it out by accident, and I'm in possession of what can alone substantiate your father's first marriage, and establish your claims to the property."
"The devil!" cried the sexton, adding, in a whisper to Luke, "You had better not be precipitate in dropping so obliging an acquaintance."
"You are jesting," said Luke to Turpin.
"It is ill jesting before breakfast," returned Dick. "I am seldom in the mood for a joke so early. What if a certain marriage certificate had fallen into my hand?"
"A marriage certificate!" echoed Luke and the sexton simultaneously.
"The only existing proof of the union of Sir Piers Rookwood with Susan Bradley," continued Turpin. "What if I had stumbled upon such a document? Nay, more, if I knew where to direct you to it."
"Peace!" cried Luke to his tormentor, and then addressing Turpin, "If what you say be true, my quest is at an end. All that I need, you appear to possess. Other proofs are secondary to this. I know with whom I have to deal. What do you demand for that certificate?"
"We will talk about the matter after breakfast," said Turpin. "I wish to treat with you as friend with friend. Meet me on those terms, and I'm your man. Reject my offer, and I turn my mare's head and ride back to Rookwood. With me now rest all your hopes. I've dealt fairly with you, and I expect to be fairly dealt with in return. It were idle to say, now I have an opportunity, that I should not turn this luck to my account. I were a fool to do otherwise. You cannot expect it. And then I have Rust and Wilder to settle with. Though I have left them behind, they know my destination. We have been old associates. I like your spirit. I care not for your haughtiness. But I will not help you up the ladder to be kicked down myself. Now you understand me. Whither are you bound?"
"To Davenham Priory, the gypsy camp."
"The gypsies are your friends?"
"They are."
"I'm alone."
"You are safe."
"You pledge your word that all shall be on the square? You will not mention to one of that canting crew what I have told you?"
"With one exception, you may rely upon my secrecy."
"Whom do you except?"
"A woman, bad. Never trust a petticoat.
I will answer for her with my life.
And for your grandad there?
He will answer for himself, said Peter. You need not fear treachery in me. Honour among thieves, you know.
Or where else should you seek it? Rejoined Turpin. For it has left all other classes of society. Your highwayman is your only man of honour. I will trust you both, and you shall find you may trust me. After breakfast, as I said before, we will bring the matter to a conclusion. Tip us your saddle, Sir Luke, and I'm satisfied. You shall rule in Rookwood, I'll engage, ere a week be flown, and then... But so much parleying is dull work. Let's make the best of our way to breakfast.
And away they cantered. A narrow bridle road conducted them singly through the defiles of a thick wood. Their route lay in the shade, and the air felt chilly amidst the trees, the sun not having attained sufficient altitude to penetrate its depths, while overhead was all warmth and light. Quivering on the tops of the timber, the horizontal sunbeams created, in their refraction, brilliant prismatic colourings and filled the air with motes like golden dust. Our horseman heeded not the sunshine or the shade. Occupied each with his own train of thought, they silently rode on. Davenham Wood, through which they urged their course, had, in the olden time, been a forest of some extent. It was then an appendage to the domains of Rookwood, but had passed from the hands of that family to those of a wealthy, adjoining landowner and lawyer, Sir Edward Davenham, in the keeping of whose descendants it had ever after continued. A noble wood it was, and numbered with many patriarchal trees, ancient oaks with broad, gnarled limbs, which the storms of 500 years had vainly striven to uproot, and which were now sternly decaying, gigantic beech-trees, with silvery stems shooting smoothly upwards, sustaining branches of such size that each, dissevered, would itself have formed a tree, populous with leaves, and variegated with rich autumnal tints. The sprightly sycamore, the dark chestnut, the weird witch elm, the majestic elm itself, festooned with ivy, every variety of wood, dark, dense, and intricate, composed the forest through which they rode. And so multitudinous was the timber, so closely planted, so entirely filled up with a thick, matted vegetation, which had been allowed to collect beneath, that little view was afforded, had any been desired by the parties, into the labyrinth of the grove. Tree after tree, clad in the glowing livery of the season, was passed, and as rapidly succeeded by others. Occasionally a bough projected over their path, compelling the riders to incline their heads as they passed, but, heedless of such difficulties, they pressed on. Now the road grew lighter, and they became at once sensible of the genial influence of the sun. The transition was as agreeable as instantaneous. They had opened upon an extensive plantation of full-grown pines, whose tall, branchless stems grew up like a forest of masts, and freely admitted the pleasant sunshine. Beneath those trees, the soil was sandy and destitute of all undergrowth, though covered with brown, hair-like fibres and dry cones shed by the pines. The agile squirrel, that freest denizen of the grove, starting from the ground as the horseman galloped on, sprang up the nearest tree, and might be seen angrily gazing at the disturbers of his haunts, beating the branches with his forefeet in expression of displeasure. The rabbit darted across their path. The jays flew screaming amongst the foliage. The blue cushat, scared at the clatter of the horse's hoofs, sped on swift wing into quarters secure from their approach. While the party-coloured pies, like curious village gossips, congregated to peer at the strangers, expressing their astonishment by loud and continuous chattering. Though so gentle of ascent as to be almost imperceptible, it was still evident that the path they were pursuing gradually mounted a hillside, and when at length they reached an opening, the view disclosed the eminence they had insensibly won. Pausing for a moment upon the brow of the hill, Luke pointed to a stream that wound through the valley, and tracing its course, indicated a particular spot amongst the trees. There was no appearance of a dwelling-house, no cottage roof, no white canvas shed to point out the tents of the wandering tribe whose abode they were seeking. The only circumstance betokening that it had once been the haunt of man were a few grey monastic ruins, scarce distinguishable from the stony barrier by which they were surrounded. and the sole evidence that it was still frequented by human beings was a thin column of pale blue smoke that arose in curling wreaths from out the brake, the light-coloured vapour beautifully contrasting with the green umbrage whence it issued. "Our destination is yonder," exclaimed Luke, pointing in the direction of the vapour.
"I'm glad to hear it," cried Turpin, "as well as to perceive there is someone awake. That smoke holds out a prospect of breakfast. No smoke without fire, as old Lady Scanmag said, and I'll wager a trifle that fire was not lighted for the fater fellows to count their fingers by. We shall find three sticks, and a black pot with a kid seething in it, I'll engage. These gypsies have picked out a prettyish spot to quarter in, quite picturesque, as one may say, and but for that telltale smoke, which looks for all the world like a Dutch skipper blowing his morning cloud, no one need know of their vicinity. A pretty place, upon my soul."
The spot, in sooth, merited Turpin's eulogium. It was a little valley in the midst of wooded hills, so secluded that not a single habitation appeared in view. Clothed with timber to the very summits, excepting on the side where the party stood, which verged upon the declivity, these mountainous ridges presented a broken outline of foliage, variegated with tinted masses of bright orange, timber, and deepest green. Four hills hemmed in the valley. Here and there a grey slab of rock might be discerned amongst the wood, and a mountain ash figured conspicuously upon a jutting crag immediately below them. Deep sunken in the ravine, and concealed in part from view by the wild herbage and dwarf shrubs, ran a range of precipitous rocks, severed, it would seem, by some diluvial convulsion, from the opposite mountain side, as a corresponding rift was there visible, in which the same dip of strata might be observed, together with certain ribbed cavities, matching huge bolts of rock which had once locked these stony walls together. Washing this cliff swept a clear stream, well known and well regarded, as it waxed in width by the honest brethren of the angle, who seldom, however, tracked it to its rise amongst these hills. The stream found its way into the valley through a chasm far to the left, and rushed thundering down the mountainside in a boiling cascade. The valley was approached in this direction from Rookwood by an unfrequented carriage road, which Luke had, from prudential reasons, avoided. All seemed consecrated to silence, to solitude, to the hush of nature. Yet this quiet scene was the chosen retreat of lawless depredators, and had erstwhile been the theatre of feudal oppression. We have said that no habitation was visible, that no dwelling tenanted by man could be seen, but following the spur of the furthest mountain hill, some traces of a stone wall might be discovered, and upon a natural platform of rock stood a stern, square tower, which had once been the donjon of the castle, the lords of which had called the four hills their own. A watchtower had then crowned each eminence, every vestige of which had, however, long since disappeared. Sequestered in the vale stood the priory before alluded to, a monastery of grey friars of the Order of St. Francis, some of the venerable walls of which were still remaining, and if they had not reverted to the bat and the owl, as is wont to be the fate of such sacred structures, their cloistered shrines were devoted to beings whose natures partook, in some measure, of the instincts of those creatures of the night, a people whose deeds were of darkness, and whose eyes shunned the light. Here the gypsies had pitched their tent. And though the place was often, in part, deserted by the vagrant horde, yet certain of the tribe, who had grown into years, over whom Barbara Lovell held queenly sway, made it their haunt, and were suffered by the authorities of the neighbourhood to remain unmolested. A lenient piece of policy which, in our infinite regard for the weal of the tawny tribe, we recommend to the adoption of all other justices and knights of the shire. Bidding his grandsire have regard to his seat, Luke leapt a high bank, and, followed by Turpin, began to descend the hill. Peter, however, took care to provide for himself. The descent was so perilous, and the footing so insecure, that he chose rather to trust to such conveyance as nature had furnished him with, than to hazard his neck by any false step of the horse. He contrived, therefore, to slide off from behind, shaping his own course in a more secure direction. He who has wandered amidst the Alps must have often had occasion to witness the wonderful sure-footedness of the mountain pilot, the mule. He must have remarked how, With tenacious hoof, he will claw the rock, and drag himself from one impending fragment to another, with perfect security to his rider. How he will breast the roaring currents of air, and stand unshrinking at the verge of almost unfathomable ravines. But it is not so with the horse. Fleet on the plain, careful over rugged ground, he is timid and uncertain on the hillside, and the risk incurred by Luke and Turpin in their descent of the almost perpendicular sides of the cliff was tremendous. Peter watched them in their descent with some admiration and with much contempt.
"He will break his neck of a surety," said he, "but what matters it? As well now as hereafter."
So saying, he approached the verge of the precipice, where he could see them more distinctly. The passage along which Luke rode had never before been traversed by horse's hoof. Cut in the rock, it presented a steep zigzag path amongst the hills, without any defence for the foot traveller, except such as was afforded by a casual clinging shrub, and no protection whatever existed for a horseman. The possibility of anyone attempting the passage not having, in all probability, entered into the calculation of those who framed it. Added to this, the steps were of such unequal heights, and withal so narrow, that the danger was proportionately increased.
10,000 devils!" cried Turpin, staring downwards. "Is this the best road you've got?"
"You will find one more easy," replied Luke, "if you ride for a quarter of a mile down the wood, and then return by the brookside. You will meet me at the priory." "No," answered the highwayman boldly. "If you go, I go too. It shall never be said that Dick Turpin was afraid to follow where another would lead. Proceed." Luke gave his horse the bridle, and the animal slowly and steadily commenced the descent, fixing his forelegs upon the steps, and drawing his hinder limbs carefully after him. Here it was that the lightness and steadiness of Turpin's mare was completely shown. No Alpine mule could have borne its rider with more apparent ease and safety. Turpin encouraged her by hand and word, but she needed it not. The sexton saw them, and, tracking their giddy descent, he became more interested than he anticipated. His attention was suddenly drawn towards Luke.
"He's gone!" cried Peter. "He falls! He sinks! My plans are all defeated! The last link is snapped!"
"No," added he, recovering his wonted composure,
"his end is not so fated."
Rook had missed his footing. He rolled stumbling down the precipice a few yards. Luke's fate seemed inevitable. His feet were entangled in the stirrup. He could not free himself. A birch tree, growing in a chink of the precipice, arrested his further fall. But for this timely aid, all had been over. Here, Luke was enabled to extricate himself from the stirrup and to regain his feet. Seizing the bridle, he dragged his faulty steed back again to the road.
"You've had a narrow escape, by Jove," said Turpin,
who had been thunderstruck with the whole proceeding.
"Those big cattle are always clumsy. Devilish lucky it's no worse."
It was now comparatively smooth travelling, but they had not as yet reached the valley, and it seemed to be Luke's object to take a circuitous path. This was so evident that Turpin could not help commenting upon it. Luke evaded the question. "The crag is steep there," said he. "Besides, to tell you the truth, I want to surprise them."
"Ha, ha, ha," laughed Dick. "Surprise them, eh? What a pity the birch tree was in the way. You would have done it properly then. Egad, here's another surprise."
Dick's last exclamation was caused by his having suddenly come upon a wide gully in the rock, through which dashed a headlong torrent crossed by a single plank.
"You must be mad to have taken this road," cried Turpin,
gazing down into the roaring depths in which the waterfall raged, and measuring the distance of the pass with his eye.
"So, so, Bess, aye. Look at it, wench. Curse me, Luke, if you think your horse will do it, and therefore turn him loose."
But Dick might as well have bidden the cataract to flow backwards. Luke struck his heels into his horse's sides. The steed galloped to the brink, snorted, and refused the leap.
"I told you so, he can't do it," said Turpin.
"Well, if you're obstinate, a wilful man must have his way. Stand aside while I try it for you." Patting Bess, he put her to the gallop. She cleared the gulf bravely, landing her rider safely upon the opposite rock.
"Now then," cried Turpin, from the other side of the chasm. Luke again urged his steed. Encouraged by what he had seen, this time the horse sprang across without hesitation. The next instant, they were in the valley. For some time they rode along the banks of the stream in silence. A sound at length caught the quick ears of the highwayman.
"Hist!" cried he. "Someone sings! Do you hear it?"
"I do," replied Luke, the blood rushing to his cheeks.
"And could give a guess at the singer, no doubt," said Turpin, with a knowing look. "Was it to hear yon woodlark that you nearly broke your own neck, and put mine in jeopardy?"
"Prithee be silent," whispered Luke.
"I am dumb," replied Turpin. "I like a sweet voice as well as another."
Clear as the note of a bird, yet melancholy as the distant dole of a vesper bell, arose the sound of that sweet voice from the wood. A fragment of a Spanish gypsy song it warbled. Luke knew it well. Thus ran the romance:
La Gitanilla. By the Guadalquivir, ere the sun be flown, by that glorious river sits a maid alone. Like the sunset splendour of that current bright, shone her dark eyes tender as its witching light. Like the ripple flowing, tinged with purple sheen, darkly, richly glowing, is her warm cheek seen. 'Tis the Gitanilla by the stream doth linger, in the hope that eve will her lover bring her. See, the sun is sinking, all grows dim and dies. See, the waves are drinking glories of the skies. Day's last lustre playeth on that current dark, yet no speck betrayeth his long-looked-for bark. 'Tis the hour of meeting, nay, the hour is past. Swift the time is fleeting, fleeteth hope as fast. Still the Gitanilla by the stream doth linger, in the hope that night will her lover bring her. The tender trembling of a guitar was heard in accompaniment of the ravishing melodist. The song ceased.
"Where is the bird?"
asked Turpin.
"Move on in silence, and you shall see," said Luke, and keeping upon the turf, so that his horse's tread became inaudible, he presently arrived at a spot where, through the boughs, the object of his investigation could plainly be distinguished, though he himself was concealed from view. Upon a platform of rock, rising to the height of the trees, nearly perpendicular from the river's bed, appeared the figure of the gypsy maid. Her footstep rested on the extreme edge of the abrupt cliff, at whose base the water boiled in a deep whirlpool, and the bounding chamois could not have been more lightly poised. One hand rested upon her guitar, the other pressed her brow. Braided hair of the jettiest dye and sleekest texture was twined around her brow in endless twisted folds. Rolled as it was in many a curious fret, much like a rich and curious coronet, upon whose arches 20 cupids lay, and were as tied or loth to fly away. And so exuberant was this rarest of feminine ornament, that, after encompassing her brow, it was passed behind, and hung down in long thick plaits almost to her feet, sparkling as the sunbeams that played upon her dark yet radiant features, were the large, black, oriental eyes of the maiden, and shaded with lashes long and silken. Hers was a Moorish countenance, in which the magnificence of the eyes eclipses the face, be it ever so beautiful, an effect to be observed in the angelic pictures of Murillo. And the lovely contour is scarcely noticed in the gaze which those long, languid, luminous orbs attract. Sybil's features were exquisite, yet you looked only at her eyes. They were the lodestars of her countenance. Her costume was singular, and partook, like herself, of other climes. Like the Andalusian dame, her choice of colour inclined towards black, as the material of most of her dress was of that sombre hue. A bodice of embroidered velvet restrained her delicate bosom's swell. A rich girdle, from which depended a silver chain, sustaining a short poniard, bound her waist. Around her slender throat was twined a costly kerchief, and the rest of her dress was calculated to display her slight, yet faultless figure to the fullest advantage. Unconscious that she was the object of regard, she raised her guitar, and essayed to touch the chords.
She struck a few notes and resumed her romance. Swift that stream flows on, swift the night is wearing, yet she is not gone, though with heart despairing. Her song died away. Her hand was needed to brush off the tears that were gathering in her large dark eyes. At once her attitude was changed. The hair could not have started more suddenly from her form. She heard accents well known concluding the melody. Dips an oar splash, hark, gently on the river, 'tis her lover's bark. On the Guadalquivir, hark, a song she hears. Every note she snatches as the singer nears, her own name she catches. Now the Giantilla stays not by the water, for the midnight hour hath her lover brought her. It was her lover's voice. She caught the sound at once, and starting as the roe would arouse herself at the hunter's approach, bounded down the crag, and ere he had finished the refrain, was by his side. Flinging the bridle to Turpin, Luke sprang to her and caught her in his arms. Disengaging herself from his ardent embrace, Sybil drew back, abashed at the sight of the highwayman. "Heed him not," said Luke. "It is a friend."
"He is welcome here, then," replied Sybil. "But where have you tarried so long, dear Luke?" continued she, as they walked to a little distance from the highwayman. "What hath detained you? The hours have passed wearily since you departed. You bring good news?"
"Good news, my girl, so good, that I falter even in the telling of it. You shall know all anon. And see, our friend yonder grows impatient. Are there any stirring? We must bestow a meal upon him, and that forthwith. He's one of those who would brook not much delay."
"I came not to spoil a love-meeting," said Turpin, who had good-humouredly witnessed the scene, "but in sober seriousness, if there is a stray capon to be met within the land of Egypt, I shall be glad to make his acquaintance. Methinks I sent a stew afar off."
"Follow me," said Sybil. "Your wants shall be supplied."
"Stay," said Luke. "There is one other of our party whose coming we must abide."
"He is here," said Sybil, observing the sexton at a distance. "Who is that old man?"
"My grandsire, Peter Bradley."
"Is that Peter Bradley?" asked Sybil.
"Aye, you may well ask whether that old dried-up otomy, who ought to grin in a glass case for folks to stare at, be kith and kin of such a bang-up cove as your fancy man Luke," said Turpin, laughing. "But, if faith he is."
"Though he is your grandsire, Luke," said Sybil, "I like him not. His glance resembles that of the evil eye."
And, in fact, the look which Peter fixed upon her was such as the rattlesnake casts upon its victim, and Sybil felt like a poor fluttering bird under the fascination of that venomous reptile. She could not remove her eyes from his, though she trembled as she gazed. We have said that Peter's orbs were like those of the toad. Age had not dimmed their brilliancy. In his harsh features you could only read bitter scorn or withering hate, but in his eyes resided a magnetic influence of attraction or repulsion. Sybil underwent the former feeling in a disagreeable degree. She was drawn to him as by the motion of a whirlpool, and involuntarily clung to her lover.
"It is the evil eye, dear Luke."
"Tut, tut, dear Sybil. I tell you it is my grandsire."
"The girl says it rightly, however," rejoined Turpin. "Peter has a confounded ugly look about the ogles, and stares enough to put a modest wench out of countenance. Come, come, my old earthworm, crawl along, we've waited for you long enough. Is this the first time you've seen a pretty lass, eh?"
"It's the first time I've seen one so beautiful," said Peter, "and I crave her pardon if my freedom has offended her. I wonder not at your enchantment, grandson Luke, now I behold the object of it. But there is one piece of counsel I would give to this fair maid. The next time she trusts you from her sight, I would advise her to await you at the hilltop. Otherwise, the chances are shrewdly against your reaching the ground with neck unbroken."
There was something, notwithstanding the satirical manner in which Peter delivered this speech, calculated to make a more favourable impression upon Sybil than his previous conduct had inspired her with. And having ascertained from Luke to what his speech referred, she extended her hand to him, yet not without a shudder as it was enclosed in his skinny grasp. It was like the fingers of Venus in the grasp of a skeleton.
"This is a little hand," said Peter, "and I have some skill myself in palmistry. Shall I peruse its lines?"
"Not now, in the devil's name," said Turpin, stamping impatiently. "We shall have old Ruffian himself amongst us presently, if Peter Bradley grows gallant."
Leading their horses, the party took their way through the trees. A few minutes' walking brought them in sight of the gipsy encampment, the spot selected for which might be termed the Eden of the valley. It was a small green plain, smooth as a well-shorn lawn, kept ever verdant, save in the spots where the frequent fires had scorched its surface by the flowing stream that rushed past it, and surrounded by an amphitheatre of wooded hills. Here might be seen the canvas tent with its patches of varied colouring, the rude-fashioned hut of primitive construction, the kettle slung between two poles upon a stick transverse, the tethered beasts of burden, the horses, asses, dogs, carts, caravans, wains, blocks, and other movables and immovables belonging to the wandering tribe. Glimmering through the trees at the extremity of the plain appeared the ivy-mantled walls of Davenham Priory. Though much had gone to decay, enough remained to recall the pristine state of this once majestic pile and the long broken line of Saxon arches that still marked the cloister wall. The piers that yet supported the dormitory, the enormous horseshoe arch that spanned the court, and above all, the great marigold or circular window which terminated the chapel, and which, though now despoiled of its painted honours, retained, like the skeleton leaf, its fibrous intricacies entire. All eloquently spoke of the glories of the past, while they awakened reverence and admiration for the still enduring beauty of the present. Towards these ruins Sybil conducted the party.
"Do you dwell therein?"
asked Peter, pointing towards the priory.
"That is my dwelling," said Sybil.
"It is one I should covet more than a modern mansion," returned the sexton.
"I love those old walls better than any house that was ever fashioned," replied Sybil.
As they entered the prior's close, as it was called, several swarthy figures made their appearance from the tents. Many a greeting was bestowed upon Luke, in the wild jargon of the tribe. At length, an uncouth, dwarfish figure, with a shock head of black hair, hopped towards them. He seemed to acknowledge Luke as his master.
"What ho, grasshopper!" said Luke. "Take these horses and see that they lack neither dressing nor provender." "And hark ye, grasshopper," added Turpin, "I give you a special charge about this mare. Neither dress nor feed her till I see both them myself. Just walk her for 10 minutes, and if you have a glass of ale in the place, let her sip it."
"Your bidding shall be done,"
chirped the human insect, as he fluttered away with his charges. A motley assemblage of tawny-skinned varlets, dark-eyed women and children, whose dusky limbs betrayed their lineage in strange costume and of wild deportment, checked the path, muttering welcome upon welcome into the ear of Luke as he passed. As it was evident that he was in no mood for converse, Sybil, who seemed to exercise considerable authority over the crew, with a word dispersed them, and they herded back to their respective habitations. A low door admitted Luke and his companions into what had once been the garden, in which some old moss-encrusted apple and walnut trees were still standing, bearing a look of antiquity almost as venerable as that of the adjoining fabric. Another door gave them entrance to a spacious chamber, formerly the eating-room or refectory of the Holy Brotherhood, and a goodly room it had been, though now its slender, lanceolated windows were stuffed with hay to keep out the air. Large holes told where huge oaken rafters had once crossed the roof, and a yawning aperture marked the place where a cheering fire had formerly blazed. As regarded this latter spot, the good old custom was not, even now, totally abrogated. An iron plate, covered with crackling wood, sustained a ponderous black cauldron, the rich steam from which gratefully affected the olfactory organs of the highwayman.
"That augurs well," said he, rubbing his hands. "Still hungering after the flesh-pots of Egypt," said the sexton, with a ghastly smile.
"We will see what that kettle contains," said Luke.
"Hadassah! Grace!"
exclaimed Sybil, calling. Her summons was answered by two maidens, habited not unbecomingly in gipsy gear.
"Bring the best our larder can furnish," said Sybil, and use dispatch. You have appetites to provide for, sharpened by a long ride in the open air.
And by a night's fasting, said Luke, and solitary confinement to boot.
And a night of business, added Turpin, and plaguey perplexing business into the bargain.
And the night of a funeral, too, doled Peter, and that funeral of father's. Let us have breakfast speedily, by all means. We have rare appetites.
An old oaken table, it might have been the self-same upon which the holy friars had broken their morning fast, stood in the middle of the room. The ample board soon groaned beneath the weight of the savoury cauldron, the unctuous contents of which proved to be a couple of dismembered pheasants, an equal proportion of poultry, great gouts of ham, mushrooms, onions, and other piquant condiments, so satisfactory to Dick Turpin that, upon tasting a mouthful, he absolutely shed tears of delight. The dish was indeed the triumph of gypsy cookery, and so sedulously did Dick apply himself to his mess, and so complete was his abstraction, that he perceived not he was left alone. It was only when about to wash down the last drumstick of the last fowl with a can of excellent ale that he made his discovery.
"What? Oh, gone? And Peter Bradley, too? What the devil does this mean?" mused he. "I must not muddle my brain with any more pharaoh, though I have feasted like a king of Egypt. That will never do. Caution, Dick, caution. Suppose I shift yon brick from the wall and place this precious document beneath it. Ah, Luke will never play me false. And now for Bess, bless her black skin. She'll wonder where I've been so long. It's not my way to leave her to shift for herself, though she can do that on a pinch."
Soliloquizing thus, he arose and walked towards the door. End of chapter 2, book 3. Chapter 3, book 3, of Rookwood. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This reading by Paul Curran. Rookwood by William Harrison Ainsworth. Book 3, Chapter 3, Sybil. The wiving vine that round the friendly elm twines her soft limbs and weaves a leafy mantle, for her supporting lover dares not venture to mix her humble boughs with the embraces of the more lofty cedar. Glapthorne, Albertus Wallenstein. Beneath the mouldering wall, whither they had strayed to be free from interruption, and upon a carpet of the greenest moss, sat Sybil and her lover. With eager curiosity she listened to his tale. He recounted all that had befallen him since his departure. He told her of the awful revelations of the tomb, of the ring that, like a talisman, had conjured up a thousand brilliant prospects, of his subsequent perils, his escapes, his rencontre with Lady Rookwood, his visit to his father's body, and his meeting with his brother. All this she heard with a cheek now flushed with expectation, now made pale with apprehension, with palpitating bosom and suppressed breath. But when taking a softer tone, love, affection, happiness inspired the theme, and Luke sought to paint the bliss that should be theirs in his new estate, when he would throw his fortune into her lap, his titles at her feet, and bid her wear them with him, when, with ennobled hand and unchanged heart, he would fulfil the troth plighted in his outcast days. In lieu of tender, grateful acquiescence, the features of Sybil became overcast, the soft smile faded away, and, as spring sunshine is succeeded by the sudden shower, the light that dwelt in her sunny orbs grew dim with tears.
Why is this, dear Sybil? Said Luke, gazing upon her in astonishment, not unmingled with displeasure. To what am I to attribute these tears? You do not, surely, regret my good fortune?
Not on your account, dear Luke, returned she, sadly. The tears I shed were for myself, the first, the only tears I have ever shed for such a cause, and, added she, raising her head like a flower surcharged with moisture, they shall be the last. This is inexplicable, dear Sybil. Why should you lament for yourself, if not for me? Does not the sunshine of prosperity that now shines upon me gild you with the same beam? Did I not even now affirm that the day that you saw me enter the hall of my forefathers should dawn upon our espousals? True, but the sun that shines upon you to me wears a threatening aspect. The day of those espousals will never dawn. You cannot make me the Lady of Rookwood. What do I hear? Exclaimed Luke, surprised at this avowal of his mistress, sadly and deliberately delivered. Not wed you? And wherefore not? Is it the rank I have acquired, or hope to acquire, that displeases you? Speak, that I may waste no further time in thus pursuing the shadows of happiness, while the reality fleets from me. And are they shadows? And is this the reality, dear Luke? Question your secret soul, and you will find it otherwise. You could not forgo your triumph. It is not likely. You have dwelt too much upon the proud title which will be yours to yield it to another, when it may be won so easily. And above all, when your mother's reputation and your own stained name may be cleared by one word breathed aloud, would you fail to utter it? No, dear Luke. I read your heart. You would not. And if I could not forgo this, wherefore is it that you refuse to be a sharer in my triumph? Why will you render my honours valueless when I have acquired them? You love me not. Not love you, Luke. Approve it, then. I do approve it. Bear witness to the sacrifice I am about to make of all my hopes, at the shrine of my idolatry to you. Bear witness the agony of this hour. Bear witness the horror of the avowal that I can never be yours. As Luke Bradley, I would joyfully, oh, how joyfully, have been your bride, as Sir Luke Rookwood. And she shuddered as she pronounced the name. I can never be so. Then, by heaven, Luke Bradley, will I remain. But wherefore, not as Sir Luke Rookwood? Because, replied Sybil, with reluctance, because I am no longer your equal. The gypsy's low-born daughter is no mate for Sir Luke Rookwood. Love cannot blind me, dear Luke. It cannot make me other than I am. It cannot exalt me in my own esteem, nor in that of the world which you, alas, too soon will mingle, and which will regard me even as, no matter what, it shall not scorn me as your bride. I will not bring shame and reproach upon you. Oh, if for me, dear Luke, the proud ones of the earth were to treat you with contumely, this heart would break with agony. For myself, I have pride sufficient, perchance too much. Perchance 'tis pride that actuates me now. I know not, but for you I am all weakness, as you were heretofore. I would have been to you the tenderest and truest wife that ever breathed, as you are now. Hear me, Sybil. Hear me out, dear Luke. One other motive there is that determines my present conduct, which, were all else surmounted, would in itself suffice. Ask me not what it is. I cannot explain it. For your own sake, I implore you, be satisfied with my refusal. What a destiny is mine! Exclaimed Luke, striking his forehead with his clenched hand. No choice is left me. Either way, I destroy my own happiness. On the one hand stands love. On the other, ambition, yet neither will conjoin. Pursue, then, ambition, said Sybil, energetically. If you can hesitate, forget that I have ever existed, forget you have ever loved, forget that such a passion dwells within the human heart, and you may still be happy, though you are great. And do you deem, replied Luke, with frantic impatience, that I can accomplish this, that I can forget that I have loved you, that I can forget you? Cost what it will, the effort shall be made. Yet, by our former love, I charge you to tell me what has wrought this change in you. Why do you now refuse me? I have said you are Sir Luke Rookwood, returned Sybil, with painful emotion. Does that name import nothing? Imports it aught of ill? To me, everything of ill. It is a fated house. Its line are all predestined.
"To what?" demanded Luke. "To murder," replied Sybil, with solemn emphasis. "To the murder of their wives. Forgive me, Luke, if I have dared to utter this. Yourself compelled me to it." Amazement, horror, wrath kept Luke silent for a few moments. Starting to his feet, he cried, "And can you suspect me of a crime so foul? Think you, because I shall assume the name, that I shall put on the nature likewise of my race? Do you believe me capable of aught so horrible?" "Oh, no, I believe it not. I am sure you would not do it. Your soul would reject with horror such a deed. But if fate should guide your hand, if the avenging spirit of your murdered ancestress should point to the steel, you could not shun it then." "In heaven's name, to what do you allude?" "To a tradition of your house," replied Sybil. "Listen to me, and you shall hear the legend." And with a pathos that produced a thrilling effect upon Luke, she sang the following ballad. The Legend of the Lady of Rookwood. Grim Ranulph home hath at midnight come from the long wars of the roses, and the squire who waits at his ancient gates at secret dark discloses. To that varlet's words no response accords his lord, but his visage stern grows ghastly white in the wan moonlight, and his eyes like the lean wolf's burn. To his lady's bower at that lonesome hour, unannounced, is Sir Ranulph gone. Through the dim corridor, through the hidden door, he glides, she's all alone. Full of holy zeal doth his young dame kneel at the meek Madonna's feet. Her hands are pressed on her gentle breast, and upturned is her aspect sweet. Beats Ranulph's heart with a joyful start as he looks on her guiltless face, and the raging fire of his jealous ire is subdued by the words of grace. His own name shares her murmured prayers, more freely can he breathe. But ah, that look, why doth he pluck his poniard from his sheath? On a footstool throne lies a costly gown of Say and of Minerva, a mantle fair for the dainty wear of a miniard cavalier, and on it flung to a bracelet hung, a picture meets his eye. "By my father's head," grim Ranulph said, "false wife, thy end draws nigh. From off its chain hath the fierce knight ta'en that fond and fatal pledge. His dark eyes blaze, no word he says, thrice gleams his dagger's edge. Her blood it drinks, and as she sinks, his victim hears his cry. For kissed impure of paramour, adulterous dost thou die." Silent he stood, with hands in brooding gore, and a glance of fame. And thus her plaint, in accents faint, made his ill-fated dame. "Kind heaven can tell that all too well I've loved thee, cruel lord, but now with hate commensurate, assassin, thou'rt abhorred. I've loved thee long through doubt and wrong, I've loved thee and no other, and my love was pure for my paramour, for alas, he was my brother. The red, red rose on thy banner glows, on his pennon gleams the white, and the bitter feud that ye both have rued forbid ye to renight. My bower he sought, what time he thought thy jealous vassal slept. Of joy we dreamed, and never deemed that watch those vassals kept. An hour flew by too speedily, that picture was his boon. Ah, little thrift to me that gift, he left me all too soon. Were worth the hour dark fates did lower, when our hands were first united, for my heart's firm truth, mid tears and ruth, with death hast thou requited. In prayer sincere, full many a year of my wretched life I've spent, but to hell's control would I give my soul to work thy chastisement. These wild words said, lugged root to head, and Ranulph's life-blood froze, for the earth did gape as an awful shape from out its depths arose. "Thy prayer is heard, hell hath concurred," cried the fiend, "thy soul is mine. Like fate may dread, each dame shall wed with Ranulph or his line. Within the tomb to wait her doom is that hapless lady sleeping, and another bride by Ranulph's side through the livelong night is weeping. This dame declines, a third repines and fades like the rest away. Her lot she rues, whom a Rookwood woos, cursed is her wedding day." "And this is the legend of my ancestress," said Luke, as Sybil's strains were ended.
"It is," replied she. "An idle tale," observed Luke, moodily.
"Not so," answered Sybil. "Has not the curse of blood clung to all your line? Has it not attached to your father, to Sir Reginald, Sir Ralph, Sir Ranulph, to all? Which of them has escaped it? And when I tell you this, dear Luke, when I find you bear the name of this accursed race, can you wonder if I shudder at adding to the list of victims of that ruthless spirit, and that I tremble for you? I would die for you willingly, but not by your hand. I would not by that blood which I would now pour out for you as freely as water should rise up in judgment against you. For myself, I have no tears. For you, 1,000. My mother, upon her deathbed, told me I should never be yours. I believed her not, for I was happy then. She said that we should never be united. Or, if united..."
"What, in heaven's name?"
"That you would be my destroyer. How could I credit her words then? How can I doubt them now when I find you are at Rookwood? And think not, dear Luke, that I am ruled by selfish fears in this resolution. To renounce you may cost me my life, but the deed will be my own. You may call me superstitious, credulous. I have been nurtured in credulity. It is the faith of my fathers. There are those, methinks, who have an insight into futurity, and such boding words have been spoken, that they may be true or false. I will not risk their fulfilment in my person. I may be credulous, I may be weak, I may be erring, but I am steadfast in this. Bid me perish at your feet, and I will do it. I will not be your fate. I will not be the wretched instrument of your perdition. I will love, worship, watch, serve, perish for you, but I'll not wed you."
Exhausted by the vehemence of her emotion, she would have sunk upon the ground had not Luke caught her in his arms. Pressing her to his bosom, he renewed his passionate protestations. Every argument was unavailing. Sybil appeared inflexible.
"You love me as you have ever loved me," said she, at length.
"A thousandfold more fervently," replied Luke. "Put it to the test."
"How, if I dare to do so? Consider well. I may ask too much."
"Name it. If it be not to surrender to you, by my mother's body, I will obey you."
"I would propose an oath."
"Ha!
A solemn, binding oath, that, if you wed me not, you will not wed another. Ha! Do you start? Have I appalled you?"
"I start. I will take it.
Hear me, by—"
"Hold!" exclaimed a voice behind them. "Do not forswear yourself."
And immediately afterwards the sexton made his appearance. There was a malignant smile upon his countenance. The lovers started at the ominous interruption.
"Begone!" cried Luke. "Take not that oath," said Peter, "and I leave you. Remember the counsel I gave you on our way hither."
"What counsel did he give you, Luke?"
inquired Sybil eagerly of her lover.
"We spoke of you, fond girl," replied Peter. "I cautioned him against the match. I knew not your sentiments, or I had spared myself the trouble. You have judged wisely. Were he to wed you, ill would come of it, but he must wed another."
"Must?" cried Sybil, her eyes absolutely emitting sparkles of indignation from their knight-like depths, and, unsheathing as she spoke the short poniard which she wore at her girdle, she rushed towards Peter, raising her hand to strike.
"Must wed another, and dare you counsel this?"
"Put up your dagger, fair maiden," said Peter calmly. "Had I been younger, your eyes might have had more terrors for me than your weapon. As it is, I am proof against both. You would not strike an old man like myself, and of your lover's kin."
Sybil's uplifted hand fell to her side. "'Tis true," continued the sexton. "I dared to give him this advice. And when you have heard me out, you will not, I am persuaded, think me so unreasonable as at first I may appear to be. I have been an unseen listener to your converse. Not that I desire to pry into your secrets, far from it. I overheard you by accident. I applaud your resolution, but if you are inclined to sacrifice all your lover's weal, do not let the work be incomplete. Bind him not by oaths which he will regard as spiders' webs to be burst through at pleasure. You see, as well as I do, that he's bent on being Lord of Rookwood, and, in truth, to an aspiring mind, such a desire is natural.
is praiseworthy. It will be pleasant, as well as honourable, to efface the stain cast upon his birth. It will be an act of filial duty in him to restore his mother's good name, and I, her father, laud his anxiety on that score. Though, to speak the truth, fair maid, I am not so rigid as your nice moralists in my view of human nature, and can allow a latitude to love which their nicer scruples will not admit. It will be a proud thing to triumph over his implacable foe, and this he may accomplish without marriage, interrupted Sybil angrily. True, returned Peter, yet not maintain it. May win it, but not wear it. You have said truly the house of Rookwood is a fated house, and it hath been said likewise, that if he wed not one of his own kindred, if that Rook mate not with the Rook, his possession shall pass away from his hands. Listen to this prophetic quatrain. When the stray Rook shall perch on the topmost bough, there shall be clamour and screeching, I trow. But of right to, and rule of, the ancient nest, the Rook that with Rook mate shall hold him possessed. You hear what these quaint rhymes say. Luke is, doubtless, the stray Rook, and a fledgling hath flown hither from a distant country. He must take her to his mate, or relinquish her and the ancient nest to his brother. For my own part, I disregard such sayings. I have little faith in prophecy and divination. I know not what Eleanor Mowbray, for she is so called, can have to do with the tenure of the estates of Rookwood. But if Luke Rookwood, after he has lorded it for a while in splendour, be cast forth again in rags and wretchedness, let him not blame his grandsire for his own want of caution. Luke, I implore you, tell me, said Sybil, who had listened, horror-stricken, to the sexton, shuddering, as it were, beneath the chilly influence of his malevolent glance. Is it true? Does your fate depend upon Eleanor Mowbray? Who is she? What has she to do with Rookwood? Have you seen her? Do you love her?
I've never seen her, replied Luke.
Thank heaven for that, cried Sybil. Then you love her not?
How were that possible? Returned Luke. Do I not say I have not seen her?
Who is she, then?
This old man tells me she's my cousin. She's betrothed to my brother Ranulph.
How? Ejaculated Sybil. And would you snatch his betrothed from your brother's arms? Would you do him this grievous wrong? Is it not enough that you must wrest from him that which he has long deemed his own? And if he has falsely deemed it so, it will not make his loss the less bitter. If you do thus wrong your brother, do not look for happiness, do not look for respect, for neither will be your portion. Even this stony-hearted old man shrinks aghast at such a deed. His snake eyes are buried on the ground. See, I have moved even him.
And in truth Peter did appear, for an instant, strangely moved.
'Tis nothing, returned he,
mastering his emotion by a strong effort.
What is all this to me? I never had a brother. I never had aught, wife, child, or relative that loved me. And I love not the world, nor the things of the world, nor those that inhabit the world, but I know what sways the world and its inhabitants, and that is self and self-interest. Let Luke reflect on this. The key to Rookwood is Eleanor Mowbray. The hand that grasps hers grasps those lands. Thus saith the prophecy.
It is a lying prophecy.
It was uttered by one of your race.
By whom?
By Barbara Lovell, said Peter, with a sneer of triumph.
Ha!
Heed him not, exclaimed Luke, as Sybil recoiled at this intelligence. I'm yours.
Not mine, not mine, shrieked she. But oh, not hers!
Whither go you? Cried Luke, as Sybil, half bewildered, tore herself from him.
To Barbara Lovell.
I will go with you.
No! Let me go alone. I have much to ask her. Yet tarry not with this old man, dear Luke, or close your ears to his crafty talk. Avoid him. Oh, I am sick at heart. Follow me not, I implore you. Follow me not.
And with distracted air she departed amongst the mouldering cloisters, leaving Luke stupefied with anguish and surprise. The sexton maintained a stern and stoical composure.
She is a woman, after all, muttered he. All her high-flown resolves melt like snow in the sunshine at the thought of a rival. I congratulate you, grandson Luke. You are free from your fetters.
Free? Echoed Luke. quit my sight. I loathe to look upon you. You have broken the truest heart that ever beat in woman's bosom."
"Tut, tut," returned Peter, "it is not broken yet. Wait till we hear what old Barbara has got to say, and meanwhile we must arrange with Dick Turpin the price of that certificate. The knave knows its value well. Come, be a man. This is worse than womanish." And at length he succeeded, half by force and half by persuasion, in dragging Luke away with him. End of chapter 3, book 3.
Chapter 4, Book 3 of Rookwood. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This reading by Paul Curran. Rookwood by William Harrison Ainsworth. Book 3, Chapter 4. Barbara Lovell.
Los gitanos son encantadores, adivinos, magos, curománticos, que dicen por las reas de las manos lo futuro, que ellos llaman Buenaventura, y generalmente son dados a toda superstición.
Dr. Sancho de Moncada. Discurso sobre expulsión de los gitanos.
Like a dove escaped from the talons of the falcon, Sybil fled from the clutches of the sexton. Her brain was in a whirl, her blood on fire. She had no distinct perception of external objects, no definite notion of what she herself was about to do, and glided more like a flitting spirit than a living woman along the ruined ambulatory. Her hair had fallen in disorder over her face. She stayed not to adjust it, but tossed aside the blinding locks with frantic impatience. She felt as one may feel who tries to strain his nerves, shattered by illness, to the endurance of some dreadful yet necessary pain. Sybil loved her grand-dame, old Barbara, but it was more with a love tempered by fear. Barbara was not a person to inspire esteem or to claim affection. She was regarded by the wild tribe which she ruled as their queen-elect with some such feeling of inexplicable awe as is entertained by the African slave for the obeya woman. They acknowledged her power, unhesitatingly obeyed her commands, and shrank with terror from her anathema, which was indeed seldom pronounced, but when uttered, was considered as doom. Her tribe she looked upon as her flock, and stretched her maternal hand over all, ready alike to cherish or chastise, and having already survived a generation, that which succeeded, having from infancy imbibed a superstitious veneration for the cunning woman, as she was called, the sentiment could never be wholly effaced. Winding her way, she knew not how, through roofless halls, over disjointed fragments of fallen pillars, Sybil reached a flight of steps. A door, studded with iron nails, stayed her progress. It was an old, strong oaken frame, surmounted by a Gothic arch, in the keystone of which leered one of those grotesque, demoniacal faces which the fathers of the church delighted to adorn their shrines. Sybil looked up. Her glance encountered the fantastical visage. It recalled the features of the sexton, and seemed to mock her, to revile her. Her fortitude at once deserted her. Her fingers were upon the handle of the door. She hesitated. She even drew back, with the intention of departing, for she felt that then she dared not face Barbara. It was too late. She had moved the handle. A deep voice from within called to her by name. She dared not disobey that call. She entered. The room in which Sybil found herself was the only entire apartment now existing in the priory. It had survived the ravages of time. It had escaped the devastation of man, whose ravages outstripped those of time. Octagonal, lofty, yet narrow, you saw at once that it formed the interior of a turret. It was lighted by a small oriel window, commanding a lovely view of the scenery around, and panelled with oak, richly wrought in ribs and groins, and from overhead depended a moulded ceiling of honeycomb plasterwork. This room had something, even now, in the days of its desecration, of monastic beauty about it. Where the odour of sanctity had breathed forth, the fumes of idolatry prevailed, but imagination, ever on the wing, flew back to that period,
and a tradition to that effect warranted the supposition, when, perchance, it had been the sanctuary and the privacy of the prior's self. Wrapped in a cloak composed of the skins of various animals, upon a low pallet, covered with stained scarlet cloth, sat Barbara. Around her head was coiffed, in folds like those of an Asiatic turban, a rich, though faded, shawl, and her waist was encircled with the magical zodiacal zone, proper to the sorceress, the Mago Sineo of the Zingara, whence the name Zingaro, according to Moncada, which Barbara had brought from Spain. From her ears depended long golden drops of curious antique fashioning, and upon her withered fingers, which looked like a coil of lizards, were hooped a multitude of silver rings of the purest and simplest manufacture. They seemed almost of massive unwrought metal. Her skin was yellow as the body of a toad, corrugated as its back. She might have been steeped in saffron from her fingertips, the nails of which were of the same hue, to such portions of her neck as were visible, and which was puckered up like the throat of a turtle. To look at her, one might have thought the embalmer had experimented her art upon herself. So dead, so bloodless, so blackened seemed the flesh, where flesh remained, leather could scarce be tougher than her skin. She seemed like an animated mummy. A frame so tanned appeared calculated to endure for ages, and perhaps might have done so. But alas, the soul cannot be embalmed. No oil can re-illumine that precious lamp, and that Barbara's vital spark was fast waning was evident from her heavy, bloodshot eyes, once of a swimming black, and lengthy as a witch's, which were now sinister and sunken. The atmosphere of the room was as strongly impregnated as a museum with volatile odours, emitted from the stores of drugs with which the shelves were loaded, as well as from various stuffed specimens of birds and wild animals. Barbara's only living companion was a monstrous owl, which, perched over the old gypsy's head, hissed a token of recognition as Sybil advanced. From a hook, placed in the plaster roof, was suspended a globe of crystal glass, about the size and shape of a large gourd, filled with a pure, pellucid liquid, in which a small snake, the Egyptian aspic, described perpetual gyrations. Dim were the eyes of Barbara, yet not altogether sightless. The troubled demeanour of her grandchild struck her as she entered. She felt the hot drops upon her hand, as Sybil stooped to kiss it. She heard her vainly stifled sobs. "What ails you, child?" said Barbara, in a voice that rattled in her throat, and hollow as the articulation of a phantom. "Have you heard tidings of Luke Bradley? Has any ill befallen him? I said you would either hear of him or see him this morning. He's not returned, I see. What have you heard?"
"He is returned," replied Sybil faintly, "and no ill hath happened to him."
"He is returned, and you are here," echoed Barbara. "No ill hath happened to him, thou sayest. Am I to understand there is to you?"
Sybil answered not. She could not answer.
I see," said Barbara, more gently, her head and hand shaking with paralytic affection. "A quarrel, a lover's quarrel. Old as I am, I have not forgotten my feelings as a girl. What woman ever does if she be woman? And you, like your poor mother, are a true-hearted wench. She loved her husband, as her husband should be loved, Sybil. And though she loved me well, she loved him better, as was right. Ah, it was a bitter day when she left me for Spain. For though to one of our wandering race all countries are alike, yet the soil of our birth is dear to us, and the presence of our kindred dearer. Well... well, I will not think of that. She's gone. Nay, take it not so to heart, wench. Luke has a hasty temper. 'Tis not the first time I have told you so. He will not bear rebuke, and you have questioned him too shrewdly touching his absence. Is it not so? He did not. Trust me, you will have him seek your forgiveness ere the shadows shorten beneath the noontide sun.
Alas, alas, said Sybil sadly, this is no lover's quarrel, which may at once be forgotten and forgiven. Would it were so!"
"What is it, then?" asked Barbara.
and without waiting Sybil's answer, she continued with vehemence,
"Has he wronged you? Tell me, girl, in what way? Speak, that I may avenge you. If your wrong requires revenge, are you blood of mine, and think I will not do this for you, girl? None of the blood of Barbara Lovell were ever unrevenged. When Richard Cooper stabbed my first-born Francis, he fled to Flanders to escape my wrath, but he did not escape it. I pursued him thither. I hunted him out, drove him back to his own country, and brought him to the gallows. It took a power of gold. What matter? Revenge is dearer than gold, and as it was with Richard Cooper, so shall it be with Luke Bradley. I will catch him, though he run. I will trip him, though he leap. I will reach him, though he flee afar. I will drag him hither by the hair of his head," added she, with a livid smile, and clutching at the air with her hands, as if in the act of pulling someone towards her. "He shall wed you within the hour, if you will have it, or if your honour need that it should be so. My power is not so departed from me. My people are yet at my command. I am still their queen, and woe to him that offendeth me."
"Mother, mother," cried Sybil, affrighted at the form she had unwittingly aroused, "he has not injured me. 'Tis I alone who am to blame, not Luke."
"You speak in mysteries," said Barbara.
"Sir Piers Rookwood is dead."
"Dead?"
echoed Barbara, letting fall her hazel rod.
"Sir Piers dead?
And Luke Bradley?"
"Ha!
Is his successor."
"Who told you that?"
asked Barbara, with increased astonishment. "Luke himself. All is disclosed." And Sybil hastily recounted Luke's adventures. "He is now Sir Luke Rookwood."
"This is news, in truth," said Barbara, "yet not news to weep for. You should rejoice, not lament. Well, well, I foresaw it. I shall live to see all accomplished, to see my Agatha's child ennobled, to see her wedded, aye, to see her well wedded."
"Dearest mother."
"I can endow you, and I will do it. You shall bring your husband not alone beauty, you shall bring him wealth."
"But, mother..."
"My Agatha's daughter shall be Lady Rookwood."
"Never! It cannot be."
"What cannot be?"
"The match you now propose."
"What mean you, silly wench? Ha! I perceive the meaning of those tears. The truth flashes upon me. He has discarded you."
"No, by the heaven of heavens, he is still the same, unaltered in affection."
"If so, your tears are out of place."
"Mother, it is not fitting that I, a gypsy born, should wed with him."
"Not fitting? Ha! And you, my child, not fitting? Get up, or I will spurn you. Not fitting? It is fitting. You shall have a dower as ample as that of any lady in the land. Not fitting? Do you say so because you think that he derives himself from a proud and ancient line? Ancient and proud. Ha! I tell you, girl, that for his one ancestor I can number 20. For the years in which his lineage hath flourished, my race can boast centuries, and was a people, a kingdom, ere the land in which he dwells was known. What if by the curse of heaven we were driven forth, the curse of hell rests upon his house."
"I know it," said Sybil, "a dreadful curse which, if I wed him, will alight on me."
"No, not on you. You shall avoid that curse. I know a means to satisfy the avenger. Leave that to me."
"I dare not, as it can never be. Yet, tell me, you saw the body of Luke's ill-fated mother? Was she poisoned? Nay, you may speak. Sir Piers's death releases you from your oath. How died she?"
"By strangulation,"
said the old gypsy, raising her palsied hand to her throat. "Oh!" cried Sybil, gasping with horror. "Was there a ring upon her finger when you embalmed the body?"
"A ring? A wedding ring. The finger was crookened. Listen, girl, I could have told Luke the secret of his birth long ago, but the oath imposed by Sir Piers sealed fast my lips. His mother was wedded to Sir Piers. His mother was murdered by Sir Piers. Luke was entrusted to my care by his father. I have brought him up with you. I have affianced you together, and I shall live to see you united. He is now Sir Luke. He is your husband."
"Do not deceive yourself, mother," said Sybil, with a fearful earnestness. "He is not yet Sir Luke Rookwood. Would he had no claim to be so. The fortune that has hitherto been so propitious may yet desert him. Bethink you of a prophecy you uttered."
"A prophecy? Ha!"
and with slow enunciation Sybil pronounced the mystic words which she had heard repeated by the sexton. As she spoke, a gloom like that of a thundercloud began to gather over the brow of the old gypsy. The orbs of her sunken eyes expanded, and wrath supplied her frame with vigour. She arose.
"Who told you that?" cried Barbara.
"Luke's grandsire, Peter Bradley."
"How learned he it?" said Barbara. "It was to one who hath long been in his grave I told it. So long ago it had passed from my memory. 'Tis strange. Old Sir Reginald had a brother, I know, but there is no other of the house."
"There is a cousin, Eleanor Mowbray."
"Ha! I see, a daughter of that Eleanor Rookwood who fled from her father's roof. Fool, fool! Am I caught in my own toils? Those words were words of truth and power, and compel the future, and the will be, with chains of brass. They must be fulfilled, yet not by Ranulph. He shall never wed Eleanor."
"Whom then shall she wed?"
"His elder brother."
"Mother!" shrieked Sybil, "do you say so? Oh, recall your words."
"I may not. It is spoken. Luke shall wed her."
"Oh, God, support me!"
exclaimed Sybil.
"Silly wench, be firm. It must be as I say. He shall wed her, yet shall he wed her not. The nuptial torch shall be quenched as soon as lighted. The curse of the Avenger shall fall, yet not on thee."
"Mother," said Sybil, "if sin must fall upon some innocent head, let it be on mine, not upon hers. I love him, I would gladly die for him. She is young, unoffending, perhaps happy. Oh, do not let her perish."
"Peace, I say," cried Barbara, "and mark me, this is your birthday. 18 summers have flown over your young head. 80 winters have sown their snows on mine. You have yet to learn. Years have brought wrinkles. They have brought wisdom likewise. To struggle with fate, I tell you, is to wrestle with omnipotence. We may foresee, but not avert your destiny. What will be, shall be. This is your 18th birthday, Sybil. It is a day of fate to you. In it occurs your planetary hour, an hour of good or ill, according to your actions. I have cast your horoscope. I have watched your natal star. It is under the baleful influence of Scorpion, and fiery Saturn sheds his lurid glance upon it. Let me see your hand. The line of life is drawn out distinct and clear. It runs. Ha! What means that intersection? Beware! Beware, my Sybil! Act as I tell you and you are safe. I will make another trial by the crystal bowl. Attend."
Muttering some strange words, sounding like a spell, Barbara, with the bifurcate hazel staff which she used as a divining rod, described a circle upon the floor. Within this circle she drew other lines from angle to angle, forming seven triangles, the bases of which constituted the signs of a septilateral figure. This figure she studied intently for a few moments. She then raised her wand and touched the owl with it. The bird unfolded its wings and arose in flight, then slowly circled round the pendulous globe. Each time it drew nearer, until at length it touched the glassy bowl with its flapping pinions.
"Enough!"
ejaculated Barbara, and at another motion from her rod the bird stayed its flight and returned to the perch. Barbara arose. She struck the globe with her staff. The pure lymph became instantly tinged with crimson, as if blood had been commingled with it. The little serpent could be seen within, coiled up and knotted, as in the struggles of death.
"Again, I say, beware!" ejaculated Barbara solemnly. "This is ominous of ill!"
Sybil had sunk from faintness on the pallet. A knock was heard at the door.
"Who is without?" cried Barbara.
"'Tis I, Balthazar," replied a voice.
"Thou mayest enter,"
answered Barbara, and an old man with a long beard, white as snow, reaching to his girdle, and a costume which might be said to resemble the raiment of a Jewish high priest, made his appearance. This venerable personage was no other than the Patrico, or Hierophant, of the Canting Crew.
"I come to tell you that there are strangers, ladies, within the priory," said the Patrico gravely. "I have searched for you in vain," continued he, addressing Sybil. "The younger of them seems to need your assistance."
"Whence come they?" exclaimed Barbara.
"They have ridden, I understand, from Rookwood," answered the Patrico. "They were on their way to Davenham when they were prevented."
"From Rookwood?" echoed Sybil. "The names! Did you hear their names?"
"Mowbray is the name of both. They are a mother and a daughter. The younger is called..."
"Eleanor!"
asked Sybil, with an acute foreboding of calamity.
"Eleanor is the name, assuredly," replied the patrico, somewhat surprised.
"I heard the elder, whom I guessed to be her mother, so address her."
"Gracious God, she's here!" exclaimed Sybil.
"Here? Eleanor Mowbray here?" cried Barbara. "Within my power! Not a moment is to be lost! Balthazar, hasten round the tents. Not a man must leave this place. Above all, Luke Bradley, see that these Mowbrays are detained within the abbey. Let the bell be sounded. Quick, quick, leave this wench to me. She is not well. I have much to do. Away with thee, man, and let me know when thou hast done it."
And as Balthazar departed on his mission, with a glance of triumph in her eyes, Barbara exclaimed,
"Sir, no sooner hath the thought possessed me than the means of accomplishment appear. It shall be done at once. I will tie the knot. I will untie, and then retie it. This weak wench must be nerved to the task," added she, regarding the senseless form of Sybil. "Here is what will stimulate her."
Opening the cupboard, and taking a small phial,
"this will fortify her. And this," continued she,
with a ghastly smile, laying her hand upon another vessel,
"this shall remove her rival when all is fulfilled. This liquid shall constrain her lover to be her titled landed husband."
End of chapter 4, book 3.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app.
Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.